On the Very Idea, a philosophy podcast.
Hello, everyone. It's a freezing cold day here, one of the few minus days of the year in the southern half of Japan, and I'm trying to stay warm. There's no central heating in the houses here, only kerosene, or using your air conditioner, which doubles as a heater. So it's a bit of a challenge to stay warm. So today I'm going to try to heat things up with a question rather than a quote. And in the spirit of trivia, it is indeed very trivial. But being a philosophy nerd, I sometimes like the most trivial ones. I sometimes like the most trivial ones the most. That was twice in that sentence. That's a bit of clunky writing. Here we go. What day of the week did the Vienna Circle meet? The Vienna Circle, as you probably know, is the other name for the logical positivists. Well, although, I suppose... you could be a logical positivist without being a member of the Vienna Circle because inclusion is defined by, the ideas held rather than who you choose to meet with. But, let's not get distracted here. Once again, what day did the Vienna Circle meet? Okay. The Vienna Circle included Gustav Bergmann, Rudolf Carnap, Herbert Feigl, saying that one right, Philipp Frank, Kurt Gödel, Otto Neurath, and Frederick Wiseman. Okay, let me count down for you. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It was Thursdays at tea time. For me, Thursdays were dominated by must-see TV on NBC so many years ago. So, to each his own, I guess. But must is a command and thus doesn't have a truth value. So, for logical positivists, a slogan like must-see TV is ultimately meaningless, So, maybe they'd be immune to the sloganeering that anchored NBC's advertisements. Who knows? Anyway, on to the main of the episode. It's not often that a single philosophical argument will radically change the course of the focus of the philosophy world at a given time. Not often, but it does happen. One of those times was when W.V. O'Quine, when his paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism, toppled, stopped analytic philosophy dead in its tracks. The paper was delivered at the December 1950 annual meeting of the American Philosophical Association, the APA, as those in the know say. Held in the most American metropolis of them all, Toronto, Ontario. And a printed version appeared in the journal, the Philosophical Review, name of the journal, the Philosophical Review, the following year. That was 1951, when logical positivism was still lodged a compelling hold on analytic philosophy. At that time, logical positivism defined analytic philosophy, and in a way, it still does, through its legacy and the lessons learned from its overindulgence of ambition. And the often pulpy, headline-esque words of that great chronicler of American philosophy, history, American philosophical history, history of philosophy, Richard Rorty. According to him, the paper rocked the audience back on its heels, and after its publication, it went on to become the most discussed and influential article in the history of the 20th century Anglophone philosophy. According to University of Sydney professor of philosophy, Peter Godfrey Smith, this paper is sometimes regarded as the most important in all of 20th century philosophy. Quine, quite lofty praise indeed, isn't it, for Quine. So, given this context, we must first talk about the logical positivist project if we are to give a decent explanation of what distinguishes analytic philosophy from its continental friend. In a sense, Logical positivism doesn't rule analytic philosophy anymore. It's more of a piece of history. Though in another sense, it's the shadow of it. It casts, it seems to have lasted longer than its time on the throne. So what was it about Quine's Two Dogmas paper that dethroned logical positivism? Well, Quine, W.V.O. Quine, brought the walls down by focusing on the logical positivist's analytic synthetic divide. That divide applied to sentences linguistically and empirically to knowledge, and semantically to a theory of meaning. So it did quite a bit of work. Quine also presents his own holistic theory of meaning within that lecture paper. And when he was done, everyone seemed to forget the logical positivist project. Though many say that that the era of logical positivism had somewhat gone before that point. So we should assume that Quine's arguments are pretty clearly, you know, they're pretty clearly nails in the coffin. We could safely assume that they would be pinnacles of what argumentation should be in analytic philosophy. You know, it should be this example of great argumentation according to the parameters of analytic philosophy. You know, shouldn't we be able to say that? Well, but perhaps Quine's arguments weren't all that great. Perhaps he just gave voice. He just gave the okay in the philosophical community to move on from a project that dominated for a bit too long, that had worn out its welcome. For a logical positivist movement, that was a bit too dismissive of any other type of philosophy, which it very much was. It was a snark. Well, how should I explore these notes? Well, I'm going to briefly look at the logical positivists in this episode. Then in the next episode, I'm going to look at Quine's paper. Then third episode, I'm going to look at philosopher Gary Gutting's critique of Quine's critique of the logical positivists. In Gutting's book, Gary Gutting's book, What Philosophers Know. In it, Gutting, he attacks the accepted truths that seem to circulate in the philosophical community and attempts to show that some of these monumental arguments are not so great when you peel back the layers in spite of their historical importance. Gary Gutting, he is no logical positivist. He just feels that there are some philosophical arguments that are given way too much credit. If Isaac Newton stood on the shoulders of giants, Gary Gutting, he attempts to take out the giants at their knees. At their knees. So let's start with the logical positivists. Logical positivism was a philosophical movement that arose in Vienna in the 1920s and met on Thursdays at tea time, as we said, and was characterized by the view that scientific knowledge is the only kind of factual knowledge and that all traditional metaphysical doctrines are to be rejected as meaningless. They were cleaning up philosophy. Well, what were they trying to do? Well, they were first, they were trying to put knowledge through the cleaners, throwing out almost anything that seemed on less than very secure scientific foundations, but leaving room for philosophy to do some work. They were trying to put philosophy on the same footing as science. They're trying to do with analytic knowledge, knowledge of the definition of terms or words and how they hang together. They're trying to do the analytic knowledge, the same things that scientists do with empirical knowledge. In this way, philosophy could be on the secure, pristine, or lofty footing that science stands on. Wouldn't that be nice, eh? They were the insecure best friend of that popular kid of academia, that popular kid, science. And instead of forging their own path, they wanted to suck up to him or her. Well, how does philosophy go about championing science, yet nevertheless carving out a space for itself to justify its tenure? Well, for the logical positivists, it started by tossing out any ethical, political, metaphysical, non-empirical forms of knowledge out in the trash, out in the garbage, with one exception, and it is an important exception, analytic truths. They were the only non-empirical thing to survive.
for the logical positivists. These are the truths of logic. They could use the work of Bertrand Russell and Frege and others on logic and language and combine it with science to give a complete, if you know, very sparse conception of knowledge. Logic certainly has the same level of certitude as, you know, empirical claims. The law of the excluded middle and modus ponens and why not modus tollens? You know, these seem to be obviously true. And even if we are committed empiricists, we still need to account for a priori knowledge. And logical positivists thought that this distinction was the best route for doing this distinction between analytic and synthetic truths. And so given the limited scope of what it would call knowledge, the world that logical positivism created was very stringent. No world spirit of Hegel, perhaps no categorical imperatives of Kant, no moral intuition of Rousseau, and certainly no Platonic forms of, well, Plato. Meaningful language was based on logic and precision, as precise as the findings of a scientific experiment, and not at all like the obscure philosophy of the past. For the logical positivists, all genuine philosophy is a critique of language, and its result is to show the unity of science, that all genuine knowledge about nature can be expressed in a single language common to all the scientists. Logical positivism was sometimes called logical empiricism, and perhaps that is, perhaps logical empiricism is a better name, because they thought the products of logic and empiricism were the only worthy candidates of knowledge. So, all knowledge backed up by the senses or by logic. It all sounds like a very nice and very tight little system. The scientists would do their experiments, and the philosophers would have language and logic and could help the scientists clear any theoretical misunderstandings with their precise understandings of language. Because a natural question here is, if science is so valued so much, then why not, you know, just be strict empiricists, right? Why not just be strict empiricists? Why go the analytic route at all? Valuing only empirical scientific-based knowledge. No need for philosophy. Well, the problem with this is that all science needs theory. Scientific theory. Yeah, fossils as evidence and evolutionary theory. Items falling to the earth and gravitational theory. Scientific theory itself requires the logical interlocking, interconnecting of ideas. And though based on empirical data, it extends beyond the strict confines of sense data and shows how all this empirical data hangs together in a logical way. Even empirical data itself was mere logical constructions out of perceptual experiences, in the sense that David Hume described. I'm going to pretend to know a lot about David Hume, but I know he said that. Anyway. Get from bare particulars to categorizing them under general concepts, you know, it requires a logical construction. So, without getting too bogged down in the detail, everything verifiable through the senses or logic, as I said. Science and logic met in scientific theory, and that's where philosophy had a role, you know, in cleaning up scientific understanding and in helping science understand the relations between perceptual experience and conceptual construction, whether the scientists asked for it or not. So, there was a division of labor, and philosophy had its place, conceptual, logical analysis. Even though some logical positives, they didn't care for the term philosophy, with Rudolf Carnap saying, philosophy is to replace by the logic of science. That is to say, by the logical analysis of the concepts and sentences of the sciences. It's his quote. Anyway. This division of labor between the sciences and philosophy rested on the analytic-synthetic distinction. Analytic statements were statements regarding the truth of logic, and synthetic statements were statements regarding the truths of empiricism. Now, Rudolf Carnap. Carnap was a prominent logical positivist. I guess he could be described as their leader. You know, there during the tea time on Thursdays. And here it is. And here is what he said about the analytic-synthetic distinction. His quote, "Since empiricism has always asserted that all knowledge is based on experience, this assertion has to include knowledge in mathematics. On the other hand, we believe that with respect to this problem, the rationalists had been right in rejecting the old empiricist view that the truth of 2 plus 2 equals 4 is contingent, merely empirical, on the observation of facts, a view that would lead to the unacceptable consequences that an a math statement might possibly be refuted tomorrow by new experience. A math statement might be refuted tomorrow by new experience if it's contingent after all. Anyway, back to the quote. Our solution based upon Wittgenstein's conception consisted in asserting the thesis of empiricism only for factual truth. By contrast, the truths of logic and mathematics are not in need of confirmation by observations, because they do not state anything about the world of facts. They hold for any possible combination of facts." End quote. Nice division there. Everyone has got something to do. Well, except for Hegel. Anyway, and once they have this analytic-synthetic distinction, the logical positivists did the natural thing and defined key concepts in their theoretical framework through this distinction. They were primarily concerned with language, as the cleaning of language was their job. So they defined concepts for things like meaning, truth, sense, and reference. The logical positivists define the meaning of state and the meaning of a sentence as how it was to be verified. So the meaning was determined by its verification. This was known as the verification principle. The meaning of the sentence "snow is white" is what we do to verify whether "snow is white," the sentence, is true or not. And that verification is, you know, it's empirical. We look at snow. In other words, we look at the actual world and see that snow is white. For a sentence like "all bachelors are unmarried men," this sentence, it's not empirical. Well, how is it to be verified if we're a logical positivist? Well, we look at the meaning of words, and we do an analytic breakdown. Sounds like a nice dance. We see that married men and bachelors are coextensive terms. One can be exchanged for the other in a sentence without changing the truth value of a sentence. It places no constraint on the world. Rather, an analytic sentence is true in virtue of its meaning. The claims that all other philosophy was meaningless obscurity because of their lack of linguistic and logical precision really painted the logical positivists themselves into a corner. Their project required this strict division between analytic and synthetic statements, because the meaning of an analytic term could only be based strictly on logical definitions. It had to be true by matter of form. If the meaning of an analytic term drew on empirical input at all, then where would we draw the lines of that concept? You know, it would, where we draw the lines, it would be just a matter of value judgment. And if it is a value judgment, then it's not a very, you know, if it's a value judgment, it's not very scientific at all. You know, you don't have value judgments in science. And that choice would have no justification either empirically or logically. And empirical and logical justification, as you remember, was the only game in town. It was the only thing that really mattered to the logical positivists. So, by their own very strict rules of the game, they required this sharp, but maybe impossible, distinction. And what is another name for a value judgment made apart from logical or empirical considerations? Well, it's not exactly the same, perhaps, but these value judgments are, you know, they're often seen as pragmatic judgments. Judgments based on our needs, interests, and expediency. Anyway, let's stop there. I think I've, touched a little bit on what the logical positives believe, and in this line of, you know, from this line of reasoning, this is where Quine jumps in, W.V.O. Quine. So we set up the analytic-synthetic distinction, and next time, let's talk about W.V.O. Quine and how he tries to take down this analytic-synthetic distinction that so much of the work of the logical positivists depend on. Yeah. And we will explore Quine's work in the next episode. Anyway, thank you for listening.
On the Very Idea, a philosophy podcast.